John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, June the 22nd, 2011. On Tuesday evening, the Israeli army started to shift a section of the illegal separation wall built on lands that belonged to residents of Bil'in village, west of the central West Bank city of Ramallah. The act came in implementation of a ruling by the Israeli Supreme Court, which was issued on the 4th of September 2007. The ruling states that the wall is illegal and illegitimate as it is built on lands privately owned by the villagers. The army started removing segments of the wall in the western part of Bil'in. That area is supposed to be fully dismantled by mid-July. If the court ruling is fully implemented, the villagers will regain 1,200 dunams out of 2,300 dunams illegally annexed by Israel for settlement and wall construction. The total size of Bil'in is 4,000 dunams. Rateb Abu Rahma, coordinator of the Popular Committee Against the Wall, stated that dismantling sections of this illegal wall comes as a result of persistent and ongoing popular non-violent resistance carried out by the residents of the village and their Israeli and international supporters. The giant Apple company has decided to allow the publishing of a new app for the iPhone carrying the name Third Intifada, in spite of Israeli pressure on the company to ban the app. The Israeli Air Force attacked an underground tunnel running from the Gaza Strip into Egypt. According to military officials, the strike was in response to a rocket fired from the Gaza Strip into the Negev Desert. Neither incident caused death or injury. The incident was the first since March, when Hamas fired a rocket at an Israeli school bus, killing one. Israel responded with air and ground strikes that killed 19 Palestinians. Since Israel imposed its siege on Gaza in 2006, secret tunnels running from Gaza into Egypt have become necessary for transporting essential supplies into Gaza, including medicine, food and construction materials. A visit to Hebron in the southern West Bank by the Archbishop of Jerusalem, Fuad Tual, was cut short on Monday when Israeli forces stopped the Archbishop from entering the centre of the city. Hundreds of Palestinians have been displaced in the Hebron area, where the central city has been taken over by Israeli settlers over the past 20 years. Although 250,000 Palestinians live in the Hebron district, an estimated 700 Israeli settlers and 1,500 Israeli soldiers have control of over two-thirds of the area. The formerly bustling market on Al-Shahada Street is now empty and under military control, a move which has devastated the economy of Hebron. Jordan's Prime Minister Maruf al-Bakhit and the UNRWA Commissioner General Filippo Grandi have appealed for monetary aid for their finances to fund the UNRWA work among Palestinian refugees. In a speech to UNRWA's Advisory Council, the two warned of instability if services to the region's 3.6 million Palestinian refugees are not continued. On Wednesday morning, four Palestinian towns, Beit Zahor, Hebron, Jenin and Nablus, were invaded by the Israeli military. In Beit Zahor, two flying checkpoints were set up, stopping cars and checking IDs. Three armed Israeli military vehicles surrounded the Al-Quds Open University, but left without making any arrests. Israeli military forces prevented a Palestinian journalist from taking photos during the raid. In addition, in Hebron, one Palestinian civilian was abducted after the town had been invaded. Current Palestinian Authority Prime Minister Salam Fayyad has said that he will not stand in the way of national reconciliation, but has declined to say that he would step down from the position of PM in the new interim government in order to achieve consensus between Fatah and Hamas. Israeli human rights organisation B'Tselem has released figures showing a steep rise in the number of housing demolitions in the West Bank compared to 2010 and 2009. According to B'Tselem, 103 residential structures in Area C, most of them tents, huts and tin shacks, in which 706 people lived, including 341 minors, were demolished by the Israeli army in 2011 so far. In comparison, during the same period in 2010, there were 86 residential demolitions, and in 2009 there were a mere 28. In the past week alone, 33 residential structures have been demolished, home to 238 persons, 129 of them minors. Many of the demolitions, according to the organisation, were in Israeli-classified firing zones in which no construction is officially allowed to take place, in spite of the fact that Israeli settlers are often allowed to build in irrespective of this. Almost half of Israeli-controlled Area C is classified as firing zones. Such demolitions are illegal under international law, except due to absolute military necessity. The Mar News Agency reports that 10 workshops have been destroyed by Israeli forces in Batar al-Sharqiya near Jenin. The workshops are located in the West Bank but are on the Israeli side of the separation wall. Significant quantities of machinery were confiscated at the same time. The demolition began at approximately 6 o'clock on Wednesday morning. The damage caused by the action is estimated at tens of millions of shekels and was allegedly carried out due to complaints by nearby settlers about smoke from the workshops. As a result of the demolitions, fires started on the property and continued for some hours until Palestinian fire crews were allowed onto the property. Two tractors belonging to Jamal Sharif Amarna and Yasser Uthman Kabha were also confiscated. That's all today from the IMEMC. This was Wednesday, the 22nd of June's daily roundup of news from the occupied Palestinian territories. We hope you will join us again tomorrow. This report has been brought to you by Hussam Khassis and me, David Steele.
Last May, the Israeli military assaulted a flotilla of civilian ships carrying thousands of tons of humanitarian aid through international waters to the Palestinian population of Gaza. The attack on one of the largest ships, the Turkish-flagged Mavi Marmara, resulted in 9 dead, dozens injured, and international protests against Israel's use of deadly force against unarmed activists. Gaza has been subject to an Israeli blockade since the militant Palestinian party Hamas took control of the territory in June 2007, and rocket attacks were launched against nearby Israeli settlements. After the violence against the aid flotilla in 2010, Israel announced it would liberalize the blockade and allow a larger number of civilian goods and supplies to enter the territory. Now, despite Israel's threats to stop them, a coalition of international groups are organizing a new flotilla of ships, which will again challenge the Israeli-Gaza blockade. Some 1,500 activists from about 100 nations will board 10 vessels in late June, which will also carry humanitarian aid, medical equipment, school supplies, and construction materials. The flotilla of boats will include the U.S.-flagged ship, the Audacity of Hope, named after President Obama's 2006 memoir. The vessel will carry 36 passengers, 4 crew members, and 10 members of the press, among them Pulitzer Prize-winning author Alice Walker and many longtime peace activists. Organizers say the boat will bring no aid, but thousands of letters of support and friendship from Americans to the people of Gaza. One quarter of the participants signed on to the U.S. boat are American Jews. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Robert Naiman, policy director of the group Just Foreign Policy. Naiman, who will be aboard the Audacity of Hope, talks about the objective of the flotilla and the significance of the number of American Jews aboard the U.S. protest ship.
There are expected to be about 10 boats. One of the boats will be an American boat. This is different from last year in that there were Americans in the flotilla last year, but there was no American boat. There's now a boat consisting entirely of Americans, the Audacity of Hope. There will be 50 people on board, 36 passengers, 4 crew, and 10 journalists, and I'll be one of the 36 passengers. And we're coming from all over the United States, New England to California, different occupations. More than a quarter of the passengers are Jewish. So we think this is a new development. This is an international movement, but it's one now with a very vibrant U.S. Component. The writer Alice Walker is going to be a passenger on the boat. Hedy Epstein, whose parents were killed in the Holocaust and who escaped from Germany to England on a Kinder transport, 86 years old today, lives in St. Louis. She will be a passenger on the U.S. boat to Gaza. And other folks that your listeners might know, Kathy Kelly, longtime peace activist, campaigned against the Iraq sanctions, she will be on the boat. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, a longtime activist with Global Exchange, she will be on the boat. There's obviously a new moment in the region in the aftermath of the revolution at Tahrir, the new Egyptian government, not a democratically elected Egyptian government, but one that's somewhat more accountable to Egyptian public opinion. We've already seen some fruit of that in the Fatah-Hamas reconciliation agreement, which the new Egyptian government helped broker, and with the announced and partially implemented steps to open somewhat the Rafah border crossing. It's turned out that that was perhaps less than the original ballyhoo. But nonetheless, it reflects the new political moment in the region where the Egyptian government is somewhat more accountable to Egyptian and Arab public opinion.
Robert, what is the objective in your mind as you board the boat to Gaza to challenge the Israeli blockade? The Israelis maintain that they've loosened and liberalized the supplies allowed to come into Gaza. As you said before, the new government in Egypt, the military government, says that they're now allowing more things in through the Rafah Gate on the Gaza-Egyptian border. What's the objective? And I know your boat actually is bringing in letters and no aid supplies at all.
It's true that the Israeli government, after the first flotilla and all the pressure, began allowing more goods into Gaza. But many aspects of the blockade that existed in May 2010 persist essentially unchanged today. It's still the case that Gazans have great difficulty importing construction materials. There's still damage that hasn't been repaired from the Israeli invasion. There's still restrictions on cement and gravel. Basically, what the Israelis have allowed is some materials in for international construction projects, but if you're a private citizen or a businessman, that's not necessarily going to help you rebuild your home or business. It's still the case that Palestinians can't freely travel to the West Bank and East Jerusalem for study or for medical care or to work. It's still the case that big swaths of agricultural land near the Israeli border is off limits to farming due to the self-declared Israeli buffer zone, a third of Gaza's arable land now off limits. And so most of the elements of the blockade remain today, and we want to call attention to that and bring pressure to that. In addition, we're not only concerned about the blockade, it's part of a larger issue of Palestinian freedom, self-determination, and independence. And we see this as a way to, together with all the other efforts going on, try and break the stalemate that is preventing Palestinians from exercising their right of self-determination.
Tell us about the significance of the numbers of Jewish people on board the boat challenging the Israeli blockade.
Well, I think it's very significant because it's an opportunity for the passengers on the boat to speak to the media and the world about their opposition to the U.S.-Israeli policy. And as you know, as the world knows, these policies are often justified in the name of Jews in general, and American Jews in particular, and U.S. policy is justified in the name of American Jews. So this is an opportunity for these American Jews on the boat. So it's an opportunity for those of us who've been marginalized by the institutions that claim to speak in our name in terms of U.S. policy towards Israel and the Palestinians. It's an opportunity for us to raise our voices and say that we're not represented by these organizations. We don't support the occupation. We don't support the oppression of the Palestinians. We want to see a different U.S. policy that supports Palestinians' right to freedom and self-determination.
That was Robert Naaman, policy director of the group Just Foreign Policy. To learn more about the Gaza flotilla challenging the Israeli blockade of Gaza, visit our website at btlonline.org.
Monday, Afghanistan. NATO is reporting the deaths of two NATO soldiers of unspecified nationality from an insurgent attack in an undisclosed area in eastern Afghanistan on Monday. Afghanistan, Tuesday. A suicide bombing targeting a governor in northern Afghanistan has killed two people, including a 14-year-old girl. The bomber detonated a suicide vest Tuesday morning outside the office of Parwan Provincial Governor Abdul Basir Solange as his car passed. Solange was not injured in the attack. Afghanistan, Monday. Two rockets fell near a base for South Korean aid workers and troops at 9:56 p.m. local time. The South Korean Foreign Ministry reported no casualties or property damage were reported. Peshawar, Pakistan, yesterday, a suicide car bomb went off outside the home of a member of a pro-government peace body, killing four and wounding five. Sama TV reported that the chief of the anti-Taliban peace militia, Ijaz Baka, was killed in the attack. Peace militia? Good grief. Baghdad, Iraq, yesterday. A bomb attached to a minibus killed the driver, but everybody else got lucky. Baghdad, Iraq, yesterday. A roadside bomb on Palestine Street killed an Iraqi soldier and wounded five people, three of them also government soldiers. Baghdad, Iraq, yesterday. Two booby-trapped cars damaged a liquor store in the city's Qurrata district. Diwania, Iraq, yesterday. Two suicide car bombs exploded outside a town council building and a governor's home, killing at least 22 people. Governor Salim Hussein Alwan said he was leaving his house when a suicide bomber rammed into a police checkpoint outside his house. Minutes later, another suicide bomber attacked the compound housing the governor's office and other governmental buildings. At least 37 people were wounded in the attacks, which occurred at about 7:30 a.m., when security forces were changing shifts, officials reported. Ramadi, Iraq, yesterday. Two booby-trapped cars were found before they could detonate and were blown up in place by security forces without other losses. Musayab, Iraq, yesterday. Five people were killed and nine wounded when a bomb went off in a restaurant. Shamali, Iraq, yesterday. A roadside bomb hit a U.S. Army patrol in southern Iraq's Babel province on Tuesday, a Babel police source told Aswat al-Iraq news agency. Wait a minute. What U.S. patrol? What roadside bomb? I thought U.S. combat operations in Iraq were over. Oh yeah, that's been said before. Baghdad, Iraq. Six bombs exploded in Baghdad today. Baghdad, Iraq, today. Five rockets were fired at a joint Iraqi-U.S. military base in the Badiyat district of eastern Baghdad, an Interior Ministry source reported. Two of the rockets hit the base and three fell outside, wounding three civilians, that source said. The U.S. military said 10 mortars were fired, but none hit the base and no casualties were reported. Amara, Iraq, today. The U.S. forces in Iraq announced today that an armed group targeted Iraqi forces stationed in Batiara Airport near Amara City with mortar shells. In a statement issued by the Southern Command of U.S. Armed Forces in Basra, as received by Aswad al-Iraq, it noted that the shells fell on the 10th Division of the Iraqi forces stationed near the airport. The statement added that there were no casualties. Samarra, Iraq, today. A roadside bomb went off after a U.S. military convoy passed by, wounding a civilian. Washington, today. President Barack Obama is talking about removing maybe 10,000 troops from Afghanistan. No more than one-third of his surge of extra troops into Afghanistan. Mr. President, don't you get it? Combat operations in Iraq were supposed to end last year, but U.S. troops are still fighting there. All U.S. troops were supposed to be out of Iraq by the end of the year, but will you comply with your obligation to remove them? How is Afghanistan going to be any different than Iraq, except perhaps even more violent? 8 years in Iraq and almost 10 in Afghanistan haven't changed anything for the better. Now's the time to pull the plug. Bring all the troops home today. Two Iraqi men were arrested in Bowling Green, Kentucky back in May. They are being charged in a grand jury indictment in U.S. domestic courts with supporting insurgents in their home country in occupied Iraq and with conspiring to bomb U.S. troops in Iraq, a country in which many people are engaged in a state of active warfare against the United States. In other words, U.S. domestic courts are claiming battlefield jurisdiction over the Iraq War. These two men are not charged with attempting to bomb anything or anyone inside the U.S. They are charged with trying to do something in Iraq, where U.S. courts are not supposed to have jurisdiction. The two men, Awad Ramadan Alwan, age 30, and Mohammed Sharif Hamadi, age 23. Assistant Attorney General Todd Heenan said, quote, over the course of roughly 8 years, Awad Ramadan Alwan allegedly supported efforts to kill U.S. troops in Iraq, first by participating in the construction and placement of improvised explosive devices in Iraq, and more recently, by attempting to ship money and weapons from the United States to insurgents in Iraq. Similar charges have been filed against Hamadi. Supporting evidence against Alwan includes a fingerprint on a shell recovered in Iraq, which is not some place the FBI or U.S. courts are supposed to have jurisdiction, except for U.S. military courts, over offenses committed by members of the U.S. military. Alwan was said to have been drawn into an FBI sting in which he boasted of attacking the U.S. Army in Iraq. In September 2010, Alwan was said to have shipped money and weapons to Sunni insurgents in Iraq. Hey, Department of Justice and President Obama, how is it that U.S. courts do not have the jurisdiction to judge men being held without trial in Guantanamo Bay, supposedly captured on the battlefield, but do have jurisdiction over someone else on the battlefield? These two Iraqis should be considered soldiers of their country, every bit as much as the U.S. Navy SEALs who entered Pakistan on the mission to kill Osama bin Laden were soldiers of their country. They may even regard themselves as being on an anti-terrorism mission when you think about what the U.S. has done to Iraq. Therefore, the U.S. may, under the laws of war, either hold these men as declared prisoners of war and also grant prisoner of war status to all the men in Guantanamo Bay, or else grant trials in civilian court to every detainee in Guantanamo Bay, as well as to these two Iraqis. Many have argued that civilian trials for anyone captured on any battlefield will lead to court jurisdiction over every shell fired and every bomb dropped in every war. Many in the U.S., especially Republicans and members of the military, fear this scenario. Why then is it okay for Awad Ramadan Alwan and Mohammed Sharif Hamadi to face charges in U.S. court, but not okay for those suspected of war crimes in Iraq, such as those infamous Blackwater contractors, to face trial in the civil courts of Iraq? This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com. We've had our share of protests here in D.C. against austerity programs and budget cuts, such as D.C. City Council Chairman Kwame Brown's failed attempt to close homeless shelters to save taxes on the rich. We've had our share of protests against the International Monetary Fund and its brand of austerity here in D.C. Greece, however, things are really hitting the fan as thousands of people take to the streets and fight, saying no to an IMF-demanded austerity program.
It's chaos in Greece. What was supposed to be a peaceful rally of 25,000 people against the country's new austerity measures instead broke down into violence Wednesday. Hundreds of protesters clashed with riot police, turning Athens into a smoke and tear gas-filled city, with rocks and firebombs being hurled through the air. Windows were smashed, and demonstrators say at least 10 people were injured in the melee.
That was last week. Since then, there's been another riot, as Greece's so-called excuse for a parliament allowed Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou to survive a vote of confidence. That vote of confidence didn't come from the street, though, and there was more rioting on the 21st of June. 75% of the Greek public is opposed to the bailout, and tens of thousands of Greek youth have shown they're willing to take to the streets and fight like something out of the movie 300 against these bailouts. If there's one thing worse than a sovereign default, it's poverty for all, which is what these bailout programs bring. And there's a message in what's happening in Greece for the Republican Party, for the Democratic Party, and yes, Mayor Gray and for Kwame Brown too. That is, if you cut people's legs out from under them, don't expect them to take it lying down. On the Xingu River in Brazil, authorities are once again trying to build a hydroelectric dam, now called Belo Monte. This dam was formerly known as Cararo, but that turned out to be the word for war, the language of an indigenous tribe opposing the dam, a tribe who threatened exactly that. The project has been stopped since 1975 by controversies over indigenous rights and forced displacement, but a license to begin construction was issued on the 1st of June this year. On the 20th of June, members of Amazon Watch and other supporters of indigenous rights in Brazil turned up outside the Brazilian embassy in Georgetown, much to the displeasure of corporate tenants of that same building.
As you may have noticed, those who own this building are trying to harass us and prevent us from being here because they don't like being embarrassed, they don't like a ruckus outside their building, and, you know, we're not trying to get arrested. But I think that if you're a business owner and you're renting to an institution that is carrying out destruction of indigenous people's land, you should expect protest. That's the
problem. Yeah. People own the property. People own the property. People own the property. People own the property.
We need to have our day, not just to fight for people in the Amazon, but to fight for social justice worldwide. It's not about pity or charity, it's about solidarity.
There are those who say that the whole reason the Europeans ever came to the Americas was because they destroyed their own rivers, the population of fish crashed, and the fishermen of Europe had to go farther and farther out to sea to find fish. Now they want to destroy the rivers of the Americas. Last year, Bank of America got over $4 billion in tax breaks. If you bought a soda at CVS, you probably paid more in taxes than Bank of America did last year. On the 21st of June, the National Alliance of HUD Tenants showed up in front of Bank of America, demanding that Bank of America pay their taxes and that GOP proposals to balance the budget on the backs of the poor be abandoned.
And the BOA, I will you pay. Why does the BOA, I will you pay. Why does the BOA?
The National Alliance of HUD 10 is in town. Many of them came from Boston, Massachusetts, down here to D.C., and it's because their organization is fighting against the cuts to HUD. The federal government is talking about cutting $5.7 billion to HUD in fiscal year 2012 because of the Paul Ryan budget, because we all know that we now have a two-party Congress.
And here are the ugly facts. In 2009, Bank of America had an income of $4.4 billion after receiving a $45 billion bailout from taxpayers. In 2009, Bank of America didn't pay a penny in taxes. In the Paul Ryan budget bill is included $4.2 billion in tax breaks for the wealthy overall. This tax break is effectively paid for, as the Republicans demand, by that $5.7 billion budget cut for HUD. That budget cut for HUD means cuts in Section 8 and cuts in public housing. And meanwhile, while the rich get a tax break financed by throwing tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of people out on the street, Bank of America alone reports assets of an excess of $2 trillion, enough to pay for all the bailouts on Earth.
If they don't pay their taxes, and the people in Washington, D.C., and Washington, in the Senate and the House, cut the budget, then 600,000 people are going to be put into the street and will have nowhere to live.
Everyone that's standing on these streets, if you paid $1 in taxes this year, you paid more than the Bank of America.
There are those who say you can't fight City Hall. There are those who say protesting is a waste of time. In D.C., however, they've just been proven wrong. When D.C. Council Chairman Kwame Brown proposed to close all homeless shelters to avoid raising taxes on the rich, about 200 protesters swarmed the Wilson Building. When they went to Kwame Brown's office, some warned that if homeless people were turned out of shelters, riots would be next.
There were tent cities, and that's what this city's gonna turn into if we don't save these benefits and shelters for people to live in. Now, also, after Dr. King's death, there were riots, or at least a riot, a terrible riot that affected a large part of the city. That can also happen. So you either go to jail now, or you go to jail next year.
They got that about the riots. As a result, Kwame Brown threw in the towel, and the shelters will stay open. He still chose to nickel and dime the middle class with fees instead of taxing the rich, but remember, it wasn't the middle class saying they would riot, and it wasn't the middle class looking at sleeping outdoors every night except during hypothermia season. Protest works. You can fight City Hall. Don't just vote. Organize. Get together with your neighbors and those you know the most. Stand up to Walmart. Stand up to City Hall.
A 5-4 decision on June 20th at the U.S. Supreme Court threw out an 11-year-old class action lawsuit filed against giant retailer Walmart, representing several women plaintiffs claiming gender discrimination and potentially representing 1.5 million female Walmart workers nationwide. The major issue in the case was whether the lawsuit satisfied a requirement of the class action rules that there are questions of law or fact common to the class filing the suit. The majority on the court ruled it did not. This high court decision raises the bar on what plaintiffs must prove before being allowed to proceed with the class action lawsuit, and will likely make it much more difficult for such class action proceedings to move forward in the future. The ruling is viewed by many legal observers as a gift to Walmart, America's largest retailer, which faced billions of dollars in claims if it had lost the case. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Chris Owens, an attorney and executive director of the National Employment Law Project. She discusses her views on the court's Walmart ruling, on the obstacles she sees for future groups of individuals seeking legal remedies to discrimination and other injustices.
Two things were particularly striking, I thought, about the decision. One was that Justice Scalia very explicitly delved into the merits of the case, and he said, you can't really decide whether the class has the kind of common interest, the common issues that are the glue, without looking at the merits and sort of the potential for prevailing. That, I thought, was really quite surprising. And then secondly, although he acknowledged that there are situations in which decision-making that is largely subjective and discretionary could be a basis for finding a commonality that would support a class certification, he disparaged every bit of the evidence that suggested that it, in fact, had been discriminatory. So I think that it makes it much, much harder, notwithstanding his saying that it would still be possible to certify a class in that kind of situation. I think it makes it much, much harder to do so, and in some sense signals to employers that they are better off not having standards and explicit policies, and instead just having and not having the kind of transparency that those kinds of standards and explicit policies provide, and instead just having a sort of more laissez-faire approach to decision making. That makes it more likely that they can avoid class certification in the future.
This would affect potential classes of all kinds, right?
It would affect any basis, race, gender, ethnicity, age, disability status, any basis that's covered by any of the civil rights laws, it would affect. I think it's not as clear that it would have the same impact in a shareholder suit, which is the other big area of class action litigation, but it may. It's just uncertain whether it would.
I thought it was interesting that Justice Scalia wrote that one factor in Walmart's favor was that it had written non-discrimination policies in place. How important do you think that was in deciding this case? And do you think that's a defense, even if the practice is different?
No, I don't think it's a defense. And I was actually fairly surprised to see that Justice Scalia attached much significance at all to it. You know, it is against the law to discriminate. Most major national corporations, and in fact, most businesses that have policies at all have written non-discrimination policies. Every business that's a federal contractor has to have a written non-discrimination policy.
Christine Owens, going forward, it sounds like these particular women, all 1.5 million of them, that their option now is to file their own individual discrimination cases, which seems unlikely in many situations. Is that what's left to them at this point?
That's one of the options that's left. Another that the attorneys for the plaintiffs have indicated they're considering, they may actually pursue these cases on a smaller basis, either looking at a specific store and sort of trying to certify a class of women who had worked or were working at that store, or all the women employed by Walmart stores within a particular region, if they could identify a specific manager who they alleged had discriminated, or policies that had been applied within that store or within that region that had had a discriminatory effect on all the women in the store within the region.
How devastating is this ruling to this group of women's efforts or to any group's efforts to win justice through class action suits?
I think it imposes an obstacle that will make certain kinds of cases, certainly large class actions involving challenges to the effects of policies that are not quite as precise. I think it will make those cases much, much harder to pursue either as national class actions or, frankly, as smaller class actions. It remains to be seen whether this ruling will be extended more broadly and have a larger impact in cases that don't track exactly what the allegations were in the Walmart case. That's one of the things that almost always happens. We have to sort of let a decision play out to assess what its ultimate impact is. It doesn't close the door to class action litigation, but it does mean that plaintiffs will have to be much more precise in terms of challenging specific practices that have a discriminatory effect or that have some genesis in discrimination. It may be hard to identify those kinds of practices because a lot of employers either have or will eliminate those kind of practices in favor of a sort of more open-ended process.
That was Chris Owens of the New York-based National Employment Law Project. Visit our website at btlonline.org to learn more about the repercussions from the court's rejection of the Walmart lawsuit.
Chocolate City, this is movement music.
Have you heard the news?
Walmart's coming.
Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something?
Something.
Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping, cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping.
Thumping.
See, you can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave laborers. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market, hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to unionize, soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than their male equivalent. On these issues and more, we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart, it's not a good fit for Chocolate City. Let me holla black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember DC doesn't work with the right wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister, Strom Thurmond, similar, Confederate, state loving George Bush ministers. Oversee your plantation mentality, results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs, and now they want to come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts. Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
Keep DC Walmart free is an emerging activist group of DC residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in DC by 2012. Walmart's in DC will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.